We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is the second hour of Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Martha Deal, Harriet Williamson, Henry Freinitz at the controls this morning. With something like 70%, close to 70% of Americans said to be overweight, it is no big surprise that here in this country, weight management is a big business. And certainly, there is good reason to be concerned about the weight of Americans and the negative effect that being overweight can have on your health. It is, however, interesting if you look back in American history now over roughly about 100 years that you see that Americans have a longstanding enthusiasm for dieting. And it was something that really goes back before the point where numbers of people who are overweight or obese started to become a problem. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll review some of this very interesting and sometimes curious history as we talk with Susan Yeager. She's an adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She's written for a variety of publications on the topics of food and sexual health, and she is the author of a newly published book that is titled The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Rodale is the publisher on the book, and I think that you would find it interesting reading, so you might want to go out and take a look at it. And, of course, as we talk here on the program, questions are welcome. We hope people can be brief, but you're welcome to join the conversation. You may call 333-9455 if you're here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. And at any point here, you have questions, comments, we'd be very happy to bring people in. And Ms. Yeager, hello.
Well, hi, David.
I appreciate you spending some time with us. It's a very, very interesting book, I think.
Well, thank you so much.
And I think, you know, one of the things that really is curious about this is that it seems that, long before the numbers of overweight and obese people really started to tick up, you know, late 70s, maybe around 1980, long before that, even amazingly enough, in the depths of the Depression, when some people, I'm sure, were struggling to keep body and soul together, people were concerned about their weight and they were going on diets.
Yep, that is absolutely true. Americans have, for a century or so, even more, kind of had a love affair with punishing themselves on these very strict starvation diets in an attempt to lose weight, even though, as you so correctly stated, until about 1975 or 1980, there was not much reason to do so.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, as you point out, that there would have been people that were maybe heavier than would have been healthy, and maybe even there were people who would have been considered to be obese, but that, you know, before the 1970s, that was a pretty small percentage of the American population.
Sure, the percentage was quite small. There are always have been, I guess always will be, some people who are a bit corpulent. I mean, if you think of the paintings of Peter Paul Rubens or Falstaff and Shakespeare, you can even find line drawings in caves of some people that are obese for whatever that reason may be. But yes, it was a very small percentage until all of the various streams and currents of our culture began to catch up with us in the 80s.
Yeah, and that's and it seems like there it's really no big mystery that we have a pretty good idea that if Americans have become heavier, it's really a combination of not enough physical activity and also maybe some not very good choices when it comes to what it is they're eating.
Yeah, that fact seems to be immutable. I mean, it was first stated in, I believe, 1757 in a treatise in London. That was the first time it was actually written down as being prescriptive, based, of course, on observation only. But it was essentially, if you eat too much, you will be heavier. You know, if you eat too little, you will be thinner. It was, you know, and that's pretty much the truth of it. What's interesting, however, is that people seem to be really fond of dieting, even if they didn't have to be.
And, you know, today I'm sure that there is some concern, maybe people even want to poke fun at some of the strange diets we have, particularly diets that are highly restrictive, where people are said that they should only eat maybe one food group or maybe even only eat a couple of things. Well, that style of dieting, also there, that's not new at all.
No, it's not new at all, and it is, it kind of angers me. Someone told me a few years ago, I didn't put this in the book, but I actually met a couple who only ate orange food. They ate salmon, they ate oranges, they ate cantaloupes, you know, a lot of good foods, actually, but a really kind of nutty thing to base a lifestyle on.
Yeah, my personal favorite, and I mentioned before about people dieting even during the Depression. I think this is something that goes back to the 30s. There was somebody who had this diet that said people should eat lamb chops and pineapple.
Oh, yes.
The lamb chop, pineapple, and that's all.
Very apparently. Popular, yeah, lamb chop and
lamb
pineapple,
chops and pineapple.
Because after all, they believed that the acid in the pineapple would absorb the fat in the lamb chops. Now, this was, of course, spread around by the marketers of pineapples, the Dole company. In fact, many diets were created by food marketers. There was a Hollywood 18-day diet in the 1930s as well. That was 585 calories, essentially of oranges, grapefruits, and a little bit of Melba toast. Well, you know, who created this? Of course, the California citrus growers. Another one, bananas and skim milk, banana people, bananas and skim milk only. It was curious, I think, that during the 30s, the worst, you know, the Great Depression, the worst economic times the country has ever known, and yet people that had some money were going on these ridiculous fad diets. I mean, that was really the start of the fad diets that are still many of them around today in different guises. And I can only believe that with things so completely out of control at that time, I mean, even if you had a job today, you might lose it tomorrow. You just didn't know. I think it was good to take control of something, even if it was just what you were having for lunch.
Yeah.
And it made it so simple if you could only choose a banana or a glass of skim milk.
And I think, too, and this is something we can talk some more about, is that that is an example of the fact that, I don't know what we want to call them, social elites, prestigious people in society, famous people, wealthy people who had, going back to the 19th century, an enthusiasm for going to exclusive health spas and having things done to them in the interest of their health. That kind, they sort of set a pattern, and that interest in approaching health, sometimes in strange ways, did indeed manage to trickle down through American society to everybody.
Absolutely. And, of course, that still goes on today. But in the 19th century, particularly the early and mid-19th century, a great deal of what the wealthy were doing, they were following people like, say, Sylvester Graham. He was a Presbyterian minister and best remembered, or I guess I should say only remembered today, as inventing the Graham cracker. But Sylvester Graham was an advocate for whole foods, yes, even then. Whole grains, whole foods, a healthy way of eating. But his reason for this was a bit different than today's reason. Graham believed that anything spicy, caffeine, meats, all of these things had to be eliminated from the diet because he thought that those things bring about lascivious thinking. he actually wasn't just against premarital sex. I mean, you know, who wasn't at that time? I mean, he was kind of against postmarital sex too. And he thought that if you follow his diet, you know, you're not going to be sexual. That's how the graham cracker came around, actually. He thought bread was far too sexy a food. You know, like
that's really funny. Yeast bread was just way too much for the man.
Way too sexy. It rose, it swelled, you had to knead it. That was such a kind of sensual thing to do. It was, after all, alive. These bacteria, this yeast is multiplying, you know, in the bread. And that's how the graham cracker actually did come about. His disciple, John Harvey Kellogg, who not only didn't like the idea of postmarital sex, he didn't engage in it. He and his wife never consummated their marriage, so they said, went on to adopt about 40 children. He began the sanitarium in Michigan, Battle Creek, Michigan, and, of course, Kellogg's Cornflakes, same thing. This sanitarium just became the haven for the rich and famous. When you look at the rosters, you see Rockefeller, Edison, people from department stores, the wife of Upton Sinclair, famous dancers, Henry Ford, on and on and on. Just about every very wealthy person of the time would cross the door of the sanitarium and watch their weight.
Yeah. This here, when you talk about Sylvester Graham and Kellogg and other people that were followers of theirs, I think what it does, it also says something very interesting. I think it tells us something about a little bit about the American personality, and something that I think persists to the present day when people talk about or think about the issue of weight. And that is, there seems to be, again, going back to the 18th century, that there was this idea that being overweight, or maybe even simply taking pleasure in what you ate, was something of a moral issue, and in fact that if you were too heavy, that it was a sign of moral failure.
Yes, definitely enjoying your food too much was a sensual thing, and it was something to kind of be curtailed. Ultimately, in the latter part of the 19th century, going into the 20th century, the calorie was actually identified. And for the first time, it was known that calories equal energy, and if you have certain foods, they have certain amounts of calories. John Harvey Kellogg was actually, in his sanitarium, one of the first people to utilize this information. The very rich and famous, Thomas Edison and John D. Rockefeller and so forth, they would meticulously write down every single thing they ate, because it was figured out that every gram of fat has 9 calories. Every gram of protein or carbohydrate has 4. They would write down what they had to the ounce. This would be multiplied out, and they would know the amount of calories they consumed. However, it wasn't until 1917 when a doctor named Lulu Hunt Peters, who was a nutritionist as well as a medical doctor, had been overweight. She published a book called Diet and Health with a Key to Calories, and it was the first best-selling diet book in the history of America. It swept the country. It was just a mega seller. At the same time, in 1917, World War I started, and suddenly, if you were too heavy, it was so important to feed the troops. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, so important to get some food. And for the first time, we knew how to ship the highest amount of energy in the smallest space. Sugar, fat, that's what we had to send them. Suddenly, if you were overweight, you were a traitor.
Yeah, it was considered to be unpatriotic.
Absolutely it was. There were posters all over. Don't help the Hun at mealtime was one of them. Absolutely. If you had a heavy body, a traitor was living inside of it.
Yeah. We have a caller here. We'll get to right to. Just let me introduce again, for anybody who might have just tuned in, our guest, Susan Yeager. She is adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Has written for a number of publications on topics of food and sexual health, and she's the author of a newly published book that's a lot of fun to read and very interesting. The title is The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight, which takes a look at, going back now a century, American attitudes about weight and the American enthusiasm for dieting, sometimes in very strange and not altogether healthy ways. And as she points out, and as we've discussed, an enthusiasm that truly predates more recent concerns about people being overweight and that being bad for generally the health for Americans. It's published by Rodale. So if you're interested, you can look for the book, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let us take this caller here in Indiana. Line number four, a toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I hope this is in the general area, but it's something that's been I found intriguing since I discovered the fact about a family member. He was a Weight Watchers poster child, as one of the family members told me. He was on a poster at least twice for losing large, you know, amount of weight, and usual picture of somebody, you know, inside an old pair of pants and stuff. He finally died overweight. He was over 500 pounds. He's about 6'2". And I started thinking about, is there some sort of psychological thing that Weight Watchers and these other peoples play on to get these people to keep coming back again and again and again? And if so, has that already been known, you know, since the 19th century? Or is this a new phenomenon in since, you know, the last few decades where a certain group of people are targeted for losing weight, and people know that they're going to be back again and again and again if they live long enough? Thanks a lot.
Wow. Well, that's a multifaceted question, really. First, let me say, I think in doing the research for the book, Weight Watchers, I think in a way is kind of one of the good guys. I mean, they give good information, and they try to change people's lifestyle, which is what very, very few other people that write, you know, the Atkins type people try to do. I certainly have absolutely no evidence that there is some nefarious plot. I think a few things. I think firstly, and as I discuss in the book, although yes, absolutely, eat more and exercise less, you will definitely gain weight. That is true for almost everyone, but it is also possible for two people to consume exactly the amount of the same amount of food, be exactly the same height, be the same sex, you do exactly the same amount of exercise. This is theoretical, of course, and weigh two different weights, because there are some people, very few, but some, that may be genetically predisposed to be overweight. There could be obesogens that we don't even know about. There's so much talk now about prenatal plastic getting into infants and possibly causing overweight. So there are a variety of reasons that certain people, again, a very, very, very small percentage, might be morbidly obese, and it could really be somewhat beyond their control, even though they still have to eat more calories than they need. Their body may be storing them more efficiently. However, having said that, I think that, and let's put any names aside, and certainly the organization that you mentioned, when we're talking about a $55 billion industry, I think that we have to kind of think that it behooves a number of, you know, there's big weight loss out there, there's big farmers, you know, farmers not only searching for a weight loss pill that is yet to be found, but also diabetes medicine and heart disease medicine and all of the medicines that are given to people who have gained too much weight. I think it's kind of evident that there's a lot of money to be made with people being overweight and obese. I mean, there's no question in my mind about that.
You know, this is really interesting. And again, actually, it makes me think back again to the Kellogg's, because it seems that, again, when you look at people who have been concerned with America's weight, America's diet, and America's health, that there seems also, though, to have been some longstanding tension between the people who, on the one hand, seem to be truly interested in let us say, the physical and moral improvement of Americans, and the people on the other hand who are interested in making money. And I think if people think about Kellogg's, what are they going to think about? cornflakes. Well, I think it is true that the guy who had the sanitarium, who was on the Moro Crusade, John Harvey, it was his brother who was the cereal guy, and that in fact I think that they actually kind of had a falling out because John Harvey thought that his brother Will, all he was interested in was making money.
Yeah, that's quite true. And Will Keith was essentially interested in that. I mean, he set up foundations and did some generous things with it, but he was the money guy. And John Harvey really was quite earnest in his beliefs. He really felt that he was helping people, and I think Sylvester Graham did as well. And there are certainly people today who are, you know, give terrific advice. But I also think that, you know, when you see certain, I mean, let's take the Atkins diet. I mean, that came about in 1972. It, of course, was just a rehash of a diet that had been around since, oh, my goodness, I want to say in 1883, a German man named Epstein published essentially a high-meat, high-fat, low-carb diet. So it had been around at least 100 years when Atkins first put it into a book. Well, that was supposed to be the diet revolution, right? The diet to end all diets. And at that time, the country wasn't particularly obese or overweight, you know, about 22-23%. Now it's close to 70%. And there's Dr. Robert Atkins died of possibly a heart attack or a stroke. They're not sure. And yet there's a new one on the shelves right now. If it's helping people, yeah. Well... it can't be, you know, certainly not part of the solution. And yet, where would that franchise be if no one needed it?
Yeah. That again, I think is a nice example of how things continue to come around. Is it? Am I remembering this right? That the man who came up with that idea that later came back as Atkins, this was the man who had lived with the Eskimos?
Well, he really was the muse of it all. Yes. Epstein was, as I say, this German scientist, and he based it on observation. Nothing was yet known about even, you know, calories or any part of nutrition at that time. Wilhelmer Stephenson was a fascinating man. He was an anthropologist from Harvard who fell in love with being an explorer. I mean, his obit in the Times called him the last of the dog sled explorers. He did it at a time, you know, before there were airplanes, before there was anything. And he went and lived with these people. Oh, my goodness, I am so sorry.
Oh, that's okay, don't worry.
I put that on silent.
Don't worry about it.
He went and lived with the Inuit people, in fact, married an Inuit woman, lived with them for many years at a time. And he found out during this time that he could live exactly the way they did, which was purely on an all-meat diet. Mm. This fascinated him. I'm going to throw this out the window now. This fascinated him. Oh, dear, I am so sorry. Because, hello?
Yes, yeah.
We're still here. I am, too.
Okay.
This fascinated him because at that time it was believed, for one thing, that scurvy would, of course, come about if people didn't have vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to prove the fact that scurvy could not, could be prevented on an all-meat diet. And he did. He did. There was an experiment with himself and another explorer in Bellevue at that time. And for a year, they lived on only meat and only fat, and they thrived. That was Atkins' muse. And that was the muse of so many other people who created all-meat, low-carb diets. Here's the flaw with that. When they were eating the all-meat diet, their meat was either wild or, of course, it was grass-fed. There were no factory-farmed animals even used yet. And the whole animal was consumed, the heart, the brain, the lungs, the kidneys, the sweetbreads. These things are packed with vitamins if the animal is grass-fed. And so they thrived. However, of course, don't try this at home. It will no longer work today.
We're at our midpoint here. Let me just again introduce our guest, Susan Yeager. She is adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and is author of a newly published book. The title is The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight, and it's published by Rodale. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I did have an email here that came in a little bit ago from someone who was enjoying the conversation, and in fact, in hearing you talk about Graham and Kellogg, was reminded of reading about a man who was active around that time, and you will, of course, know who this is. It's in the book. Someone whose big thing was chewing, and who said if people chewed their food to the point where it was practically liquefied, that would be good.
Yeah, I love this guy. His name was Horace Fletcher. And he was a corpulent man of the world. I mean, very well educated, very sophisticated, traveled the globe long before it was, you know, a common thing to do. But he couldn't get life insurance because he was too heavy. And this really made him horribly unhappy. Tried various diets. They didn't work until he settled on a plan. His plan was all food had to be chewed, masticated, as he called it. In fact, he became known as the great masticator. All food had to be chewed at least 100 times before it could be swallowed. Many foods had to be chewed more than 100 times. They had to be chewed into a liquid pulp. Well, it worked. He lost weight. People at Yale University heard about it. They tested this. The people at Yale lost weight. And it became a national craze. Everyone Fletcherized. Getting back to John Harvey, he hung big banners up in his sanitarium saying Fletcherize everywhere, all over the sanitarium. But everyone did it. You know, I hate to say everyone, but it was pretty close to that. I mean, prisoners at Sing Sing were Fletcherizing. It worked. It worked because if you Fletcherize, if you chew 100 times, you are really going to slow down what you're eating, you know?
Yeah, you'll probably end up eating less just because it takes so long.
It takes so long. You're going to eat a lot less meat. In fact, a lot of people became vegetarian simply because they didn't want to eat meat because of the Fletcherizing part of it. Also, you know, it takes about 20 minutes for your brain to register that you're full. That's why very often people that eat very quickly will weigh more than people that do kind of take their time over their dinner, talk, put down their fork, you know, think about their food, because the brain hasn't quite registered they're full, so they keep on eating. Well, if you're going to masticate every single mouthful until it's a liquid pulp, absolutely your brain is going to register when you're full.
And that seems to be a case where you'd think that people would look at that and that they would, in fact, see that people did lose weight. But then they would say, well, now, wait a minute. Let's think about this here and maybe come up with some alternative explanations for the weight loss and having the simpler one be the one that seems to make sense. Did anybody say, well, wait a minute, maybe it's just because it takes so long that people are actually consuming less food?
Well, one or two people did. I mean, one guy published an article in the Washington Post about false food facts saying that all this masticating is ridiculous and that makes eating unpleasant, you know. But most people didn't. Again, all of the usual crowd, you know, all of those A-level people, the Rockefellers and Edisons and Fords, oh, my goodness, Ford loved the Fletcherizing part of diet. They all did it. And as I say, it filtered down, but it filtered down to an incredible extent. You know, it wasn't just the wealthy and the upper middle class who were doing it. The country was doing it.
I have some other callers here. We'll talk with someone next in LaSalle on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, there's so much emphasis on being skinny and the not eating it proper at the proper restaurant, or in fact, not eating out at restaurants at all, that I think it's gone insane. You know, everybody knows what they should and they shouldn't eat. And I'm a firm believer if your family that you're around is not eating properly and not having a good diet, then you're going to go out and do the same thing. And the thing that I'm kind of dead set against, and I've been noticing this a lot lately, is that the issue of forcing people to go certain spots. In other words, some of these people that want to, say, for instance, say that all the fast food chains in this country are bad for you. Sure, they're bad for you. You know, in some respects, are you forcing me? But you're telling me that you're going to penalize the company for throwing out food that's not good for you. You know, is that going to stop people from eating bad? No, because there's just as much, if not more, in the stores. If you read all the stuff that's, you know, that we buy in packages and in canned goods, how much sodium and how things are in there. Yeah, I think this whole idea of being skinny, looking—I mean, what's your idea of the perfect body? It's gotten so crazy that it's ridiculous. I think it should be up to the consumer to educate themselves. And again, if they're in an environment in the family unit, that's not going to stop them from doing what, you know. If they don't eat healthy in a family unit, what's going to stop them, you know, by pulling the plug on all the Burger Kings and Wendy's and whatnot? And Hollywood's the same thing. Hollywood, all these movies you have to whistle.
Is there a question?
Well, I think the caller makes a couple of points that I think are interesting. I guess maybe one, when you talk about, well, what do we think is the ideal body type? That's not new, is it? I mean, how far back does the idea that being thin equates with being desirable and attractive go?
I agree. I think that was a great question as well. I mean, of course, the ideal body type just constantly changes, doesn't it? I mean, at the turn of the 20th century, you had stars like Lillian Russell, a name still known today, and this was this big, voluptuous woman. You know, she was known for her big appetite, in fact, and she was considered to be a great beauty. We had a president, Taft, who weighed 300 pounds. And then, of course, as I say, starting about 1917, it wasn't a very good thing to be heavy anymore. And it started to be, ironically, thin became just considered to be such a wonderful thing to be, very, very, very thin, just as we as a nation started getting heavier and heavier. And there is, I couldn't agree with the caller more that there is no reason to be absolutely reed thin. It's whatever is a healthy weight for you. And if you can be fit and, you know, I mean, everyone hears about BMI. Well, there have been a number of studies done. If you have a BMI over 25, which is that's the breaking point there for considered to be overweight. But if you have a BMI over 25, but you eat healthy foods and you exercise being the key, then you're going to be fit, and it's nothing to worry about. There's nothing wrong with, having a healthy diet and exercising and being just a little heavier than, movie stars say we should be. Mm. There, I agree completely.
Well, do you think that there is evidence or there's reason to believe that if restaurants were required to post nutrition information about their food, say how many calories was in a particular dish, or maybe the percentage of calories that come from fat, or how much sodium there was, or anything like that, would nudge people to make better choices?
I think so. I do think so. I mean, and I'm saying I think so because it doesn't really seem to be happening yet. But if anything, we seem to be going slightly in the other direction from the latest Gallup poll. But I do think that these things take time, and I think it is good to be educated about the amount of calories in foods. I stopped into a McDonald's the other morning. I was curious to see the calories posted there. And they had something called a big breakfast, and it was only $3.99. And it was eggs, it was bacon, it was sausages, it was biscuits, maple syrup, butter, and it was 1,350 calories.
Wow.
Now, that's more than a child needs in a day. So I think it's a really good thing, perhaps, for a parent, let's say, to see that, and the child says, this is what I want, and the parent could say, no, I don't think so, or maybe you can have it, but, you know, you're going to share this with two of your friends or something like that.
Yeah. Well, and again, that I suppose that gets at another issue that people point to is that while on the one hand you'd say it's a good thing that food in this country is quite inexpensive, that it's also true that for a relatively small amount of money, you can get a lot of calories, but they're maybe not very healthy calories.
Yeah, I mean, food is inexpensive, but mainly it is the cheap, not very nutritious food that mm-hmm. is inexpensive. Getting back to that gentleman's statement about fast food restaurants, you can go there and get, for example, the meal I just mentioned, or maybe a Happy Meal, you know, with Big Mac and fries and a Coke, none of it nutritious, none of it good for you. That's going to cost less than a salad. So why is that? It's because corn and soy, corn being high fructose corn syrup, ultimately, and also animal feed, soy, also animal feed, these are crops that are subsidized. Fruits and vegetables aren't. So we do end up with, yes, an abundance of cheap but not very healthy food.
Mm. Let's talk with someone in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to get back to your what it seems to me the thesis of the book and confirm it is this earlier anti-diet, our pro-diet America was, it was sort of part of the anti-hedonist strain in that time around the Great Awakening. And I'm wondering whether the timeline fits with Graham and Kellogg. And I think I read that, you know, this had gotten to such an extreme that there was actually a surgical solution to chronic masturbators, that it was just, it makes me think of, that looks grotesque in retrospect. And I'm just wondering whether you might think that this wave of bariatric, or however you call it, stomach shrinking surgery will look as grotesque in the future as that does now.
Oh, well, I don't think so. You're quite right about, you know, surgical procedures and all of that. You have to bear in mind that around the time of the Great Awakening, the Millerites, the Seventh-day Adventists, and indeed Kellogg's Sanitarium was an Adventist sanitarium, you have to realize that at that time, self-pleasuring was considered to be an abomination. Now, what's an abomination? I mean, you know, punishable by death was the meaning of that. So that's how seriously it was taken, and that's how terrible it was considered to be. And, of course, therefore, if you believe that, you'll do just about anything to stop it, you know, even if it means no coffee, no spices, no meat, you know, no bread. But to compare it to bariatric surgery, no, I don't think so. I think that there are, as I said, very possibly people, and for it could be psychological reasons, it could be physical reasons, genetic reasons that we just don't know enough about yet, you know, to realize why. But they are, in fact, morbidly obese, and bariatric surgery in those cases, you know, that saves lives. It really does. One thing about bariatric surgery is it is a relatively, in fact, quite, I shouldn't even say relatively, it is a very safe operation, and it works.
Is it being done by people that wouldn't be required? I don't want to belabor the analogy.
Yeah, no. I really don't think so. I don't. I mean, I would not like to think there is any surgeon who would do that. It's really being performed on the morbidly obese. I mean, you know, somewhere in the world, I can't answer that question. But the answer
so
is basically no.
Of us, I guess, morbidly obese. Not that I am, but. I guess there was one other rejoinder. The is that a city law or is that a New York wide law about the posting of the that you were referring to?
City.
It's a city.
But yeah, but it's spreading. You know, I mean, it's spreading to a lot of other towns and counties. So there are a number of areas in New York where it's posted now, and I believe outside of New York as well.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Susan Yeager. She is adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She is author of a new book. It's just out. It's titled The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Rodale is the publisher. We have another caller here to talk with, someone in Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Hi. I hear a lot about corn and soy being the culprit. That's not my observation. What I see among children and young people is sugar. Cookies, candy, soda pop. McDonald's would actually be an improvement.
May I just interject something for a moment here?
Yes,
corn, in fact, is soda pop. What makes high fructose corn syrup.
Okay.
Before that point, soda wasn't that cheap. You know, soda pop wasn't a cheap thing. It came and it was maybe 6 ounces, maybe 12 ounces. There were no big gulps. There were no 64-ounce sodas out there as there are today. You're absolutely right. The corn syrup is probably a gigantic culprit. In fact, it is. But again, it's corn. But yeah, if you want to say sugar, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, sugar is. I don't like to say any foods are bad, and of course, no foods are bad in moderation. But if you wanted to cut one thing out of your diet, it certainly would be calorically sweetened soda. It's kind of a just a worthless food.
Let's see. Now I heard, and maybe you can validate. I heard that Hershey's moved to Canada because sugar was too expensive in its country, and that just does not seem. I mean, that just seems so totally unlikely. Is that true?
I don't know. It seems unlikely to me, too, though, because of, you know, high fructose corn syrup being so cheap and that being used to replace sugar in most things. But I don't know.
And cane sugar is produced in hot climates, not Canada. So anyway, that was just my thanks very much.
No, other questions are welcome. Again, we have maybe about 10 minutes, a little bit less in this part of Focus. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I recall now, maybe it was last year anyway, talking with someone who wrote a book about weight in America and the changing American diet. And one of the points that the author made was that one of the very big changes in the way Americans eat and in what they consume over the last few decades has been in the increasing percentage of calories that come in the form, in liquid form.
Uh-huh.
That is, people are drinking a lot of high calorie beverages. And I suppose that could be soft drinks, that could be big lattes or something like that, and that they're getting a lot of their calories that way, and that previously Americans just didn't drink. No, they drank milk or they drank water, and that it wasn't that common to drink things like sweetened soda.
That is quite true. In the 100-year diet, I refer to it as the 7% solution, because 7% on average of our calories come from calorically sweetened beverages. Most of the time, it's, you know, the same old, the sodas that the woman was speaking of. But also, it is from lattes. It is from, I mean, my goodness, now our water is, you know, sweetened and vitamin water. I mean, how ridiculous is that? Or fruit juices and so forth. Well, if people just stopped drinking calorically sweetened beverages, they would be cutting 7% of those calories out of their diet. You know, that could do it. For most people, that would give them the weight loss they wanted without having to do anything else.
Yeah.
Just drink water, drink tea, you know, iced tea, drink mineral water, sparkling, and cut out the calorically sweetened beverages.
We have talked about particularly some of the odd ideas people had about health and diet and what to eat and what not to eat, say going back to the late 19th century, and some of that extends into the 20th century. When, though, science really gets much more involved in nutrition and we have better information and for example, people start talking about calories and people start to get this idea that, you know, the body's this furnace and it burns up the fuel, and if you put in more fuel than you use, well, then you're going to gain weight. I mean, when we start to have actual nutrition science, did having better information actually help?
No, not really. That's a great question. I mean, Gallup did a poll in 1950 when there started to be so much information about nutrition, because the Second World War, where we had rationing in the Second World War, we didn't in the First. So people really had to be taught, you know, how to get the most nutritional bang for their buck and you know, to get dinner on the table and so forth. And also vitamins became all the rage at that time. But Gallup did a poll in 1950, and 80% of American housewives did not know the difference between a vitamin and a calorie. So I guess we could say, you know, all of the information is great. We're getting more information now than we ever had before, and good information. You know, it's excellent information out there, but we seem to, you know, still be getting heavier. I mean, I was very heartened. There was a plateau from about 2008 to 2010 where we had leveled off and our level of overweight and obesity in the country was stable. But I just saw a report the other day that we're starting to kind of tick upward again.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you compare the experiences and the way people thought and what they did in the period of World War I and II. You talked earlier about how people, during World War I, at that time, if you were overweight, you were seen as being unpatriotic, because the idea was that you were taking food out of the mouths of the soldiers that were fighting in Europe. The idea was, instead of our eating it, we're going to ship it over to them so they can beat the Hun. Well, and at that time, it was really voluntary. It was something that people were encouraged to do because it was the right thing to do. In World War II, there was actually rationing. But then, in that case, people didn't seem to respond very well. People actually were hoarding in World War II.
Yeah, I mean, that's in a way so American, isn't it? I mean, we don't like to be told what to do. We'll do the right thing, perhaps, if it's up to us. But suddenly being told you can't have enough butter, you know, you can't have all the butter you want. And by the way, the rationing was very, very mild. A family of four could have as much as 8 pounds of sugar in the cupboard at one time, and yet people hoarded sugar. 2 sticks of butter, you know, per person a week, people hoarded butter because they were told they couldn't have it. And there really was quite a frenzy. There were food leggers at that time who, in fact, had food, you know, bootlegged food.
Yeah.
And don't forget also, we had come out of the First World War. We had come out of Prohibition, which was just a terrible time. I mean, talk about Americans not liking to be told what to do. And here the Constitution was telling them, you know, for the first time ever, before or since, you know, what they could do. And they just didn't want to be told again.
One more caller at least. Someone on a cell phone. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
I've been listening to your program, and the previous caller talked about fast food. Are you familiar with Dr. James Painter's work on portion size?
I'm not. I'm familiar with a lot of different people on portion size, but not that.
He maintains that that people are overweight because the portion sizes over the years have changed so drastically.
Oh, yes. In fact, there's a woman, Lisa Young, at NYU, in fact, who is one of the pioneers in those studies as well. And they have indeed. Our portions keep getting larger. They're supersized.
I know. I'm amazed sometimes at the quantity of food that is served. Sometimes when I go out with my friends, we'll split a meal so that, you know, we don't get so much.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea. You know, that's a good idea. Just split the meal or take half of it home, you know, just because it's on your plate. Obviously, you're wisely, you know, wise enough to realize that doesn't mean that you've got to eat it.
Well, thank you very much.
All right,
thank you.
And there again, I think part of the issue is that I suppose that people who are in the business of serving food think, well, people think it's going to be a great deal. Look at all of the food that we're giving you for, you know, however much we're charging. The only problem is that we've been told over and over again to clean your plate. So mm-hmm. I think then that there's also this impulse that if somebody puts it in front of you, well, you're supposed to eat it.
And Americans do tend to clean their plates. The woman reminded me of a study. I'm not sure how scientific it was, but it was a study done in France and in America. They asked people, when do you stop eating? And the French people would say, when we're full, when we're not hungry anymore. And the American people would answer, when there's no more food on my plate.
Just one of the many differences between attitudes in other places, particularly in Europe and the United States, where it does seem to be that people other places, it seem to enjoy their food more, and that all in America we have this very utilitarian, pragmatic streak that says, it's not that you live to eat, it's that you eat to live.
Yes. Absolutely. A steam engine in breeches is how a food writer in 1935 referred to American men, a steam engine wearing pants. Food has been, for at least the past 100 years, if not more, in America, tied into technology. And we can't seem to get that train, on the right track. And in France, in Japan, in Italy, I mean, these are cultures with tremendous love of food and great cuisines, but not high obesity.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of additional good stuff here in the book, great stories, a lot of interesting things about American life. And I would suggest people look at the book. The title is The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. That's the subtitle. It is published by Rodale and by our guest, Susan Yeager. She is adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.